don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on August 13th, 2017 and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and I examine how much it would cost for the U.S. government to buy the oil and gas industry like other countries have done, how it would be achieved politically and procedurally, and what we would do with a nationalized oil industry to wind it down and limit climate change. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. Just a quick announcement right at the beginning. This is our next to last Wednesday episode of Arsenal for Democracy. For quite a few years now, at least four or so, we've been broadcasting on WVUD on Wednesday evenings, releasing the episodes online also on Wednesdays. Episodes will now be airing starting the final week of August on Tuesdays at noon on WVUD, and they will be released online on Tuesdays as well. So that is a big schedule change for us. Please make sure that you let other people know, especially if they listen to it on the air as opposed to online. But it's always available on iTunes and arsenalfordemocracy.com. It'll just be available a day earlier. Again, this is our next to last Wednesday episode. Starting on August 29th, episodes will be airing on Tuesdays at noon on WVUD. Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
So this is the episode that I've been waiting to do for a really long time, and I think it's going to be really interesting, and it has to do with the future of the U.S. oil and gas industry. Now, previously on Arsenal for Democracy, I have made the case that the current privately owned capitalist structure of how we deal with oil and gas in this country is not really sustainable from an environmental standpoint and is going to need to be wound down faster than the free market would do it on its own. But I was pretty vague and pessimistic about that when I originally brought it up because I hadn't really looked into it that much. And I think that that's actually a persistent problem when we're talking about this issue, is that people haven't necessarily looked into the details. They haven't looked at it in a U.S. context or a global context. They haven't priced it out. They haven't figured out what that actually might look like, you know, a different alternative model. And so, you know, when I talk about it with people, I very often hear people having the same sort of initial reaction that maybe I had originally, which is, well, this is what we should do in theory, sure, but it'll never happen in practice. It's too politically insurmountable and it's too expensive to do from a budgetary standpoint. But in fact, I found while doing research all summer on this, the industry is a lot smaller than you would think. The possibility of acquiring it is a lot more feasible than you would think and doesn't cost as much as you would think, that we should be looking into this. So this episode is going to be a general overview of this topic of a future hypothetical nationalization of oil and gas. Now, we're not legal experts, so some of the details we're going to kind of be going on, you know, just our initial research into this and that sort of thing. But we want to get people to a sort of baseline understanding of what this might look like so that they can think about it and consider it, because this is probably for most people something you haven't considered before. A lot of our sort of leftist socialist comrades, people on the left, even the sort of more liberal end of the Democratic Party, progressive end, however you want to call it, they talk a lot about healthcare, socialization, single payer, that sort of thing. But this is not an issue they talk about. So we want to get people thinking about it in a similar way, because obviously the first step to achieving any sort of policy change, especially from the left, is to get sort of mass buy-in for this policy and get a lot of people talking about it and you know, raising attention on it. I mean, I don't want to sound like we're doing quote unquote raising awareness here, but this is an issue that really doesn't get talked a lot about. I also do think, as we'll talk about, that this is very similar in many ways to the situation with regard to healthcare and health insurance, that they are similarly sized industries. Similarly, they have a lot of political influence. And they both provide sort of services or goods or whatever you want to call it that are not standard economic goods. They are not well suited to a standard free market operation in general. And there are outside considerations, whether it's on the one hand, you know, health of people, or on the other hand, you know, both health of people and also health of the, you know, climate. There are these outside considerations that have to guide and shape our policy with regard to these sectors in the 21st century. Let's get some basic things out of the way. First of all, as I said, there's a climatic necessity to going toward nationalization, which is why we're talking about this in the first place. And that is just that there is a urgent 10-year window, basically, on getting our fossil fuels wound down immediately in order to have any shot at a sort of livable climate for a lot of people. Every fraction of a degree that we fail to contain is going to translate to tens of millions of deaths in various parts of the world. The other thing is that this is not as crazy as it might initially sound, because in fact, 3/4 of oil and gas is state-owned worldwide. The US, Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom are really the only significant outliers in terms of privately owned oil and gas, both in terms of where you're drilling, is it public land versus private land, as well as the actual corporate ownership. Most countries own their companies for producing oil and gas, very similarly to how many countries own the healthcare sectors in their country, either just the insurance or also the hospitals, that sort of thing. Only 10% of global production of oil and gas worldwide is private. A lot of that is coming from the United States. We are an outlier in the same way that we're an outlier on healthcare, because the 13 largest global oil firms are state-owned, according to the Wall Street Journal. So we've got this outlier fact on the one hand, we've got this scientific urgency on the other hand of needing to acquire this industry and wind it down, which is, we're going to get into the details of how that might work and what that might look like, and that it's more feasible than you might think. The other thing though, Nate, I wanted you to talk to us a little bit about this article that was recently published in The Guardian that kind of emphasizes the need to take a supply side look at how we deal with climate change.
Yeah, so as there was an article, as you mentioned, in The Guardian, just about July 10th, and basically just shows that there's about 100 companies that are responsible for 71% of global emissions. So there's a study, I guess, the Carbon Majors reports, and they just sort of go down the list looking at all these sort of different, just what percentage various companies or sectors are. So coming up the list, perhaps not too surprising, China's coal industry, about 14% of global industrial greenhouse gas emissions. Then going down the list, Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, so not particularly too surprising. You see BP, Chevron, so a lot of these are pretty familiar names, although you have a lot of smaller companies as well once you continue down that list.
Now, obviously, as you noted to me when we were planning this show, a lot of those companies, like the top one that you mentioned, are in other countries. So the United States doesn't really have that much control over them, but we obviously, as you're listing off there, some of those companies are U.S. companies, and if there was a way to control them or shut them down in a responsible and fair manner, then that would have a big impact. One of my concerns, I don't know how you feel about this, is that a lot of the environmental movement and rhetoric, whether it's well-meaning or cynical or whatever, tends to focus on individual choices like, you know, recycle more or don't eat meat or things like that, that don't really look at supply side emissions and how few companies are actually responsible for this, that it makes it into a more diffused problem that feels larger than we can cope with, rather than there are 100 companies that are responsible for 71% of the emissions.
Right. And there was actually a couple articles that came out not too long ago sort of about this question and sort of the methods through which sort of processes of neoliberalism basically individualize everything and force us to consider the climate crisis solely through our own individual actions. So as you mentioned, recycle, eat less meat, maybe have a different light bulb, but not sort of the main structural questions through which there's only one way that we're actually going to have some serious action on climate change is through changing these systems and not just everyone eating a couple less meat meals a week right. or changing their light bulbs.
And we're obviously not saying don't do those things for
yeah,
sure, but
just not sufficient.
That alone is not going to deal with it, and that you're going to have to undertake much more supply level changes in order to have like a pretty sweeping impact on any sort of timescale. I mean, the meat thing in particular, just to go off on a slight tangent, it is correct that meat for food uses up creates a lot of emissions, greenhouse gas emissions.
Methane.
That's undeniable. However, we hear a lot of people saying like, you know, you're not really doing your part on the climate change if you're not cutting out meat as an American. Meanwhile, there are millions and millions of people in China who did not previously consume meat in their diet or really didn't consume much, who are now entering this sort of westernized middle class lifestyle where eating meat is a big thing. We see Chinese companies buying US poultry companies just to have sort of supply chains to supply this amount of meat. That's sort of a good example of like, if you completely make it into a personalized individual level issue, and this is similar for like, you know, using less oil and gas, then you're never really going to be able to offset the sort of huge amounts of people that are coming online in these other countries in consuming these things. And in order to deal with that, whether it's meat or gasoline or whatever, any of these things, you're going to have to undertake it at a much more systemic level than just, you know, your individual choices, or else anything that you do as an individual is going to be canceled out. And then people are going to feel like, well, why should I bother? Or why should I sacrifice? And that is, of course, something that comes up a lot with critics, and cynically, of course, critics of any of these sort of international climate deals, is they're like, well, you know, China and India, they're not doing their part. And so why should the US hamstring itself, you know, if they're not making these commitments? And again, that's a cynical argument, but it is worth understanding that we're going to have a lot more impact if we're dealing with this on the supply side.
Yeah, and I think there's obviously a pretty big role for, say, communities to play in sort of these collective, whether it's recycling or various other environmental things that we've talked about, that has a much more significant impact than just sort of doing it on your own and just pretending, okay, that absolves me of all these issues now.
The other obviously huge consideration that deters a lot of people from contemplating any sort of fundamental change to the oil and gas industry is that they think of it as being this sort of vast monolith that could not possibly be defeated, is just simply too powerful. And so we want to challenge that a little bit as well today in the course of this discussion. Some of these numbers will become more apparent as we go through this. But again, just to give kind of an overview, in the past, oil and gas was indeed this huge titan in the U.S. economy that was just absolutely massive. You had Standard Oil, this giant cartel company, basically. In many states, the industry was just absolutely huge. If you look, though, today, like, you know, look up this economic statistics on Texas, for example, the actual amount of money that's coming from oil and gas, or even coming from the supporting industries, the companies that supply all the pipes and equipment and stuff like that, that benefit from having this sector, all of that put together, the state level equivalent of GDP, the percentage that's coming from oil and gas is actually relatively small. There's a lot of other things, the service economy in particular, that is simply much, much larger. And in California, we see similar things as well. There are a lot of places that used to have a very dominant industry, and now other things have overtaken that in size and scope. So that's one sort of way of looking at a reduced level of influence. Another thing to keep in mind, oil prices globally are very low right now. That means that any sort of influence that they have, any sort of potential cost, as we'll discuss later, for purchasing these companies in the public interest is going to be significantly lowered than when it was $200 a barrel or whatever. We're looking still right now, even after the people are saying, oh, there's going to be a rebound or whatever, it's still under $50 a barrel. And that is just a very low amount of money. A lot of wells at that level are no longer even feasible or profitable. This is kind of the moment to strike. The other thing is that in terms of political influence, they don't actually spend as much as you would think. Obviously, whether it's Exxon or Koch Industries or whatever, sure, they do spend a lot relative to a lot of other sectors. $9.5 million from the Koch Industries oil company and sort of conglomerate on various this state and federal spending. They buy a lot of legislators at the federal and state levels. No denying that they have a ton of influence. Exxon spending $6.1 million a cycle on lobbying expenses. We are absolutely cognizant of the influence here, but it should not be overstated because, for one thing, these companies, by both market capitalization and sort of political spending, are very comparable to the insurance industry. And if you're a lefty right now, you're probably pushing for single payer or Medicare for all or whatever you want to call it. And that is effectively supplanting a private industry that is influential and politically powerful with a state-owned enterprise. So if you think that's a winnable fight that we can win in the near future, you should also be considering this as a potentially winnable fight as well. The other thing is that on this political influence point, whereas, you know, the Democrats take a lot of money from the insurance companies and that sort of thing, and that kind of compromises their position with regard to the health insurance issue, the Democrats have been almost completely destroyed at the state and federal level, almost entirely by oil industry money. Whether it's the Kochs directly or one of these front groups that's being funded by the oil and gas companies, the only real influence, and it is significant, that the oil and gas industry on a global level has on the Democratic Party is that they fund a lot of think tanks in Washington that are aligned with the Democrats. But those are mostly not U.S. oil and gas companies. Those are actually mostly Persian Gulf-based interests. And that is an influence in terms of like climate change deals, but it's not necessarily an influence, or shouldn't be, on U.S.-owned companies for oil and gas. And if they are single-handedly funding the destruction of the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party should be working to eliminate them as a potential political threat. And we will, of course, circle back to that as well. But Nate, you were going to say something about this?
I think we talked about this on a previous episode about the ways various financial interests, oil interests, or pharmaceutical interests could have an impact, say, in a Democratic primary. We talked about the primary in Virginia for the governor's race and the influence of, pipeline companies that threw money to Northrum in that primary. But as you mentioned, if we're also going up against pharmaceutical companies, you have to look at the ways, a populist message can be leveraged through small donations and used to go up against, as we mentioned, the oil and gas companies, which are mostly giving to Republicans anyway. So yeah. I think if, you know, you don't really need that money, and if you can raise enough money from the people, that can be a pretty good way of, rhetorically leveraging your funding sources against the opponent. So,
yeah, I mean, the Democrats will not survive without breaking the political power of oil and gas at this point, and they're never going to be able to get that bipartisan money like they do from the health insurance industry. So it's a win-win for Democrats to be pushing this, but many Democrats can't even conceive of this, which brings us into our next point about nationalization in the 21st century. Now, as I talked about, I think last week's episode, actually, nationalization is so far out of the U.S. political vocabulary that many people at this point think of it as like expropriation, like the state shows up with police suddenly one day and seizes your company, and that's the end of it. And maybe your investors and executives get put on trial or whatever. Now, I certainly know, as does Nate, many leftists who would love to see that happen. However, for the purposes of this discussion, let's just say that we're going to stick to sort of standard constitutional means and look at what a feasible and politically likelier model of nationalization would look like. And that's something that used to happen in the United States, but tends not to anymore. And that has pushed it again out of the vocabulary. Nationalization also simply includes buyouts, right? Acquisition of companies. The U.S. has done this many times, especially when industries were starting to fail. It's actually one of the reasons why a lot of people are optimistic about the future of nationalizing or socializing health insurance, is because they think that a lot of these companies are about to collapse or go bankrupt. But of course, the tendency, instead of nationalizing lately in the past, 10, 20 years or so, maybe 30 years, has been bailouts instead. So we want to make sure that we're obviously not bailing out these companies. And even with the falling oil and gas prices, it's not likely that they're going to be in a position where it's bailout or nationalize. So we are going to have to push the envelope a little bit harder than some of these other sectors. But again, let's just keep that in mind. In all likelihood, the way nationalization of the oil and gas industry would work in the United States is that the federal government would purchase shares at fair market value or some other agreed upon value, which we can talk a little bit about the specifics of what that valuation might be. And they would purchase these shares, and then they would have control of these companies. And then, as we'll talk about toward the end of the episode, they can figure out what to do with it. We are going to make a case for a sort of special walled off, green oriented company that is specifically charged with winding down the oil and gas production, as opposed to keeping it going, but having it be state-owned. The Fifth Amendment is what allows for nationalization of anything in the United States. It is the public domain clause, specifically the takings clause, as it's often referred to. The language there is, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. That is also the reason why a buyout at a certain negotiated value would be likely to happen, as opposed to just taking it and guillotining everyone because of their crimes against humanity and the climate. So we're looking at a Fifth Amendment model here, public domain acquisition of the oil companies outright, as well as probably the actual oil and gas in the ground on private land in many parts of the country. But we're setting that aside to focus specifically on the companies themselves in this episode. So that is kind of the constitutional underpinnings of that. And we are going to get into like what an actual buyout might look like. But first, I want to have Nate read a paragraph from a really interesting paper here that is going to establish sort of the academic basis for a nationalization or buyout of the oil and gas industry. It's also going to tell us where we stand in terms of public approval or for this idea, even before anyone's actually tried to make the case. And finally, we're going to look at what the actual cost would be, because that's the part that we haven't really hit this episode so far that I really want to stress, which is that the cost is nowhere near what you would think it would be. And that, I think, has deterred a lot of people from even really looking into it. And I was sort of fascinated by this. So, Nate, what is this paper that we're going to be hearing from?
Yeah, so this is a paper called Systemic Crisis and Systemic Change in the United States in the 21st Century. The nextsystem.org, I guess, came out of Oberlin.
Oberlin.
So just looking at this paragraph, so it says, taking over and then dismantling or completely reorienting the entire fossil fuel industry would immediately remove a powerful institutional impediment to addressing climate change and greatly accelerate the transition to renewable energy. More importantly, such a drastic measure is perfectly legal and legitimate, especially if done for the public good and if the shareholders of major corporations are bought out at reasonable prices. Public recognition of the many ways in which the supposedly free market prevents swift, effective climate action is higher than has ever been, and frustrated citizens are warming to the idea of countering systemic problems with systemic solutions. Even back in 2008, even before the BP Gulf spill, Superstorm Sandy, and the California drought, or recent record-setting waves of heat and cold, a Rasmussen poll showed 29% of Americans favored nationalizing oil companies, and a further 24% were open to the idea. What would it take fiscally? At present market value, a buyout of the U.S. fossil fuel industry would undoubtedly be expensive, perhaps costing an eye-watering $1.1 trillion to take over the top 25 largest publicly traded oil, gas, and coal companies, but spread out over 7 years would be little more than $161 billion a year, a far from impossible amount.
And of course, they are emphasizing the publicly traded oil and gas companies. So, you know, Coke, I think, is not publicly traded, if I remember correctly. So there's certainly some major companies that you would have to negotiate a little bit more, but you're going to have to negotiate either way, whether it's private or publicly held shares. But I think it's interesting. They refer to this as an eye-watering $1.1 trillion, but it's not really that eye-watering. The comparison that they make is to the Iraq War. That's not necessarily the comparison that I would go with, because that wasn't sort of an ongoing, I mean, it is an ongoing expense, but it was never intended to be an ongoing expense. I think it's more instructive to look at, again, something similar like the healthcare sector. So Obamacare costs $110 billion a year in 2016. Again, that compares to their number of $161 billion. However, the total cost of Obamacare for the next 10 years, so this is 2016 to 2026, according to a Time.com article, and this is after the first several years of the sort of Affordable Care Act's costs, the next 10 years is going to cost $1.34 trillion. That's an ongoing expense over 10 years. That's setting aside the first maybe almost 5 years or so of the expenses. What we're saying here is that it would literally cost less to purchase the 25 largest oil and gas companies and coal companies that are publicly traded than it costs to do the Affordable Care Act. And that's even throwing in coal, which we haven't really been talking about that much and won't be talking about that much in this episode. It's obviously a related thing. Coal is not doing that well in general. that would be a great opportunity as well. But we are mostly focusing on oil and gas. Even if you narrow it down to just an even smaller number of these companies to have a really outsized impact right off the bat, the cost lowers even further. Also, the publicly traded value of these companies depends very heavily on the price of oil and gas, which means that every time the price of oil and gas goes down, which the price of oil certainly has been going down, that makes it cheaper to contemplate one of these buyouts. And we don't want to wait until it gets back up to $200 a barrel to do this.
Yeah, and one thing about coal, there's been a lot of coverage of the coal industry, sort of Appalachia in the wake of the Trump election. And it is interesting to see that in a lot of these coal areas, the actual number of coal jobs is extremely small. There are very few people working in the coal industry, even relative to like 20, 30 years ago. So you sort of think, okay, maybe that's something that can be dealt with, considering it's not the massive industry it once was.
Okay, so we are about to go to a break because we're at the halfway point in this episode, and I think we're at a good point for a break here in this narrative. But we've been talking about what the cost would be, why we need to do this. Again, we're looking at a number that's relatively small from a federal perspective, $1.1 trillion, especially if you basically are spreading out the cost through various mechanisms over a 10-year period. When we come back from a break, we're going to talk about how you would actually negotiate a deal like this. Some of it is going to be kind of hypothetical. Again, we're just looking at an overview, but we want to get this discussion going. So we will be back in just a few moments with a discussion of how the U.S. government would buy out the oil and gas industry and what we would do with it after we have done that. And we'll be right back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We've been talking so far this hour about why oil and gas in the United States has to be and should be nationalized through a fair acquisition of the major companies that produce oil and gas. And we've talked a little bit before the break about how much that would cost. Again, we're looking at a price tag of about $1.1 trillion, which is smaller than the cost of the Affordable Care Act by a significant amount. Now we're going to be looking first at how an actual acquisition like that might take place, followed by what we would do with the companies and the money afterwards once we have public control of this production. We talked earlier in the episode about how the Fifth Amendment allows for a public domain acquisition where the government can just say, this is in the public interest, we're going to do it, we will give you a fair price for it, but we're going to do it and you can't argue with it. Politically though, obviously, you are dealing with some very powerful interests. Again, not as powerful as some people think, as we talked about earlier in the episode, but still powerful nonetheless. It's going to be an uphill political climb, just as we have to deal with the political realities of battling insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies to get to a socialized medicine in this country. But the reality, though, is that the U.S. government holds a lot of the cards, more so than the oil and gas companies and the sort of lobby for that. The first thing to understand is that when we're talking about publicly traded companies, which is that 25 company price tag that we had quoted earlier for just over $1 trillion, these are not owned by that narrow of a concentration if they're publicly traded. That means that there's a lot of different competing interests there as shareholders, and you can negotiate with them on that kind of diffused basis of basically building up the pressure to sell and to go kind of cooperate quietly on this and not make a huge fuss about it. Obviously, somebody's going to kick up a storm about it, but there are ways essentially of getting buy-in to do this from the people that you need to get cooperation from. So there's sort of a carrot and stick strategy. We'll talk a little bit later about who the shareholders are for these oil and gas companies when we talk about the carrot. The carrot is basically full market value purchase at a fair value of shares, which would be some sort of assessed value, probably based on market capitalization, but you would have to negotiate a little bit more complicated than that, I'm guessing, because the market capitalization would change very drastically, either up or down, depending on what investors thought was about to happen if the U.S. government suddenly announced that it was going to be buying it at market cap. But the market capitalization, for those who are unfamiliar, is basically the term of how much a company is worth when you add up all of the stock together at the price that it's currently trading at. So it would be something around that value. That would be a way of considering it to be a fair value. That's what the courts have generally said under a Fifth Amendment taking procedure, public domain, is that if you're looking at a company like that, you're going to have to take it at sort of the market value. So it would be something based on that. That's the carrot. You could even, if you this is not where I would start as a starting point. You could even potentially offer some sort of very elaborate deal, like some sort of capital gains tax hiatus or something like that, to get extra cooperation from the really cranky rich guys who are going to fund political opposition to this. It's sort of like buying out dictators when you want them to go into exile quietly. Put them on a charter plane to the Caribbean and give them a sack of cash to go away and never come back. That's not where I would start it as a negotiating point. It's something that some people might be willing to consider. My preference actually is to do the complete opposite, which is to go more in the stick route, which is that if they don't take this buyout and pay their capital gains taxes as expected, we will severely increase the taxes on this buyout so that we not only don't have to spend that much money to begin with, but we recoup the money we did spend by getting a lot of it back in tax revenue. That's a very sort of pointy stick way of getting a lot of these people to cooperate, which is you can take this giant money sack that we're going to give you and go quietly, or we can take it back from you once we've bought it anyway in the end. The other thing is that there is a much easier way of diminishing the value to create leverage here, and we want to talk a little bit about that. There are some links. All of the research is going to be put up on arsenalfordemocracy.com. There will be a whole outline with all the links that we looked up, so you can look into this stuff. But like, I read some articles, you know, National Law Review, for example, had a guide to federal oil and gas leases. Obviously, not all of oil and gas production is on federal lands, but a significant portion of it is. That's some direct leverage there. That's on 10-year cycles. I think some people are maybe under the impression that these companies have these leases for like 100 years or a 999-year lease or something like that, and that we're never going to be able to claw some of this back. In fact, you really could get a lot of this back on a 10-year cycle. You could withdraw the leases. You could change how they're issued. The Obama administration was already, toward the end, was really slow walking a lot of new leases and drilling permits. It was down from thousands of new drilling sites a year on federal lands to less than 1,000 per year new sites. You could really kind of manipulate the regulations in that way to make it borderline impossible, whether it's on federal or non-federal land. You could impose carbon taxes that are really excessive. You could just set an arbitrary final date for drilling. All of these things would make it impossible to start new projects. They would also force winding down of old projects by devaluing them, preventing them from having any value from the perspective of shareholders. All of this stuff would significantly decrease the market capitalization of these companies and make it even less expensive to buy, and also put a lot of pressure on shareholders to agree to sell. But Nate, I want you to talk a little bit about this white paper from the Center for American Progress that talks a lot about how undervalued the process is right now for federal lands offshore and onshore, but especially onshore, in terms of what kind of money we're getting from these and what the federal government could do. They're obviously coming at it from a nationalization perspective, but I think it's instructive anyway.
Right. Well, the Center for American Progress is a Gulf oil financial sources notwithstanding. This is an interesting article about touching on the Mineral Leasing Act, and this is a 95-year-old piece of legislation, so going back before the Teapot Dome scandal and the Warren G. Harding administration. Talks about how the federal royalty rate for oil and gas deposits on public land is only at about 12.5% and hasn't changed since the 1920s. There's a couple states where it's significantly higher. If it's, say, on university land, I guess, in Texas, it's about 25%.
Comparing it basically that the federal rates are significantly below the rates that even a state like Texas has established for state-owned land.
Right. I think there's a pretty significant case that these could be adjusted somewhat. And so, yeah, as mentioned, rate not updated since 1920. There's been significant technological advances and market changes since then. And in 2014, the five big oil companies, so BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Shell, made about $90 billion in profits.
And they also mention in there that George W. Bush increased the offshore drilling royalties significantly above the rate, so kind of demonstrating that there is a market mismatch there. Now, obviously, the Center for American Progress perspective here is a very reformist perspective of, look at all this money that should be going to the people in the budget that we've been letting, you know, go to these private companies. We should be recouping these costs, but they're not trying to wind down the oil and gas industry in the way that we are. But again, still pretty instructive in terms of how much leverage the federal government could potentially exercise.
Right. So if, as you mentioned, George Bush twice increased the royalty rate for offshore drilling to 18.75%. And if all of the federal royalty rates were the same as this, the U.S. would get about another $730 million each year. So significant amount of money, not a ton, but there was also a fair amount of private land, say in Texas, Louisiana, which is also 25%. There's also certain other states like New Mexico, North Dakota, that charge 18.75% for oil and gas production on public land. So especially out west, there's a degree of flexibility. So you wonder if this could be a federal priority. There's a chart here that just shows a bunch of different states, and the federal onshore is significantly lower than even the lowest in, say, Wyoming or Utah and such.
Now, if you're a liberal reformist, again, your perspective here is we should be raising these rates so that we can get more money from oil and gas production. Our perspective is, oh, the federal government every 10 years has the ability to review and change the terms of these leases for these companies. Well, that's a leverage for a threat, the stick as opposed to the carrot, which is to say, instead of raising it to, you know, 20% or 25%, you could say from now on, all leases reissued or newly issued are going to be 90% royalties or 95% or almost 100% going to the government. And the purpose there is not to actually collect the money, it's to make it financially unviable for these companies to pursue this drilling, and they will lose a lot of their investments that they've already made because they were expecting to renew a lease after 10 years and get back to drilling at a much lower rate. And we're saying, no, we're going to take all of this money away from you. Again, that's a way of diminishing the sort of assessed value of the company. The other thing is that as other points of control here, interest rates on the leases is sort of the big headline one that is mentioned in this, but they also mention, and you can talk a little bit about this, the bond insurance, the minimum bids for leasing lands, the preservation fee to extend your rental. You have to keep paying a fee in order to keep your lease active. All of these things could be vastly increased, and they kind of say they're peanuts basically right now of how much people or companies are paying.
Yeah, so under a regulation going back to 1951, a company can get a nationwide bond for all of its oil and gas wells on public lands for only $150,000. And so adjusting for inflation, that'd be $1.4 million in 2015, but a statewide bond would increase basically from the rate set in 1960, and it would increase from about $10,000 to $80,000. So statewide, you can get some pretty cheap wells.
Yeah,
like.
And the bond rate, basically what that means is that they have to put up a certain minimum amount that will cover cleanup costs and things like that from any of these drilling sites. But the amount of money that they have to pay versus the amount of wells they can get on a site is such that it works out to a very small amount, like even $50 per well head, when in fact it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars per well to do a cleanup, even if you don't have an accident, just wrapping it up and cleaning it up. So this is another area where the federal government completely has the ability to just change the rate there and make it much less financially viable. Minimum bids and rental preservation fees, I mean, those are some other ones, if you could get some numbers in there.
Yeah, well, under the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, sometimes is a confusing adjective in this context because you often see associated with Black Lives Matter, but going back to that, it's only about $2 per acre as the minimum bid if you want to try to win the right to drill on a lease. With only about $2 per acre and I guess about 25% of all federal leases in the seven western states in 2015 were at that low rate. So there's a fair amount of minimum bids going out. And so also current rental rates are set at $1.50 per acre for the first 5 years and then $2 per acre after. And so the Obama administration actually was asking for input to create greater financial incentives for oil and gas companies to develop their leases promptly or relinquish them. So oftentimes companies would sit idle on non-producing leases, so they would have the control of them, but they just wouldn't be developing them, or just they would be controlling them but not really doing too much there.
And this is kind of an area again where we are diverging significantly from the liberal reform push, which is they're saying use it or lose it, which implies you want more oil and gas production to be happening, and we're saying we don't want that. We're just trying to do anything possible to threaten the value of these companies so that they have to come to the bargaining table for a buyout if they're being uncooperative about it, and we're hoping that they will be more cooperative about it. Obviously, we'll probably allude to this later, but like the BLM in general has a pretty, I would term it, disastrous focus on resource usage and trying to get more revenues out of this. And our focus is not to get more revenues out of the oil and gas industry. It's to get rid of the oil and gas industry by buying it out and doing something better with those companies and lands. The other problem, obviously, is that 7.5 or so million out of nearly 10 million barrels a day being produced of oil are on non-federal land. Similarly, 25,000 out of 30,000 billion cubic feet. I know that's a little weird how I rendered it, but anyway, just follow along there if you can. Again, showing that there's a real imbalance in terms of non-federal production versus federal land. So mostly what we've been talking about is the leverage that we have over federal lands. Again, you would have to employ other hardball tactics for private lands. You could use eminent domain to acquire mineral rights under a lot of private land for the government purposes. That would be a lot more expensive than some of the stuff we've talked about earlier, like just buying out a company. But we are looking for sort of leverage tactics. You could use pretty specialized carbon taxes just on oil and gas and maybe coal. You could really increase the red tape on private land production as well so severely that it makes it financially unviable. All of these things, this is, again, to build as much of a stick as possible to get people to the negotiating table, to negotiate a fair Fifth Amendment price for buying out the oil and gas industry, and also to play hardball so that they don't spend all of their money resisting this buyout effort politically. Sadly, according to energy.gov, the United States has long held U.S. Navy reserves. They were directly owned oil reserves for the Navy, originally created for strategic reasons, so the Navy would always have a supply of its own oil. They didn't actually produce anything on it until the 1970s, but they then privatized that off in the 1990s. So we do not have that much that is directly federally controlled already. But it does show, again, that it's not as much of an outlier as you would think to be talking about nationalizing or socializing oil and gas in this country, because we used to have it through the U.S. Navy. That's sort of the carrot and stick model. Again, who are we actually talking about in terms of these shareholders? Just for the sake of quote-unquote fairness, we went and looked at the data from the American Petroleum Institute, which is the sort of major lobbying, trade lobbying group for the U.S. oil and gas companies. They had some statistics which they thought were supposed to make them look really good about, you know, how it's millions of ordinary Americans that are the shareholders in oil and gas companies. I suspect that that maybe is not going to help them as much as they think it is. If these companies were all held by a limited number of wealthy people, most companies in general in the stock market outside of the oil and gas industry are, mostly shareholders tend to be a small number of rich people. But the oil and gas industry, 46.8% of it is owned, the shares, not the number of shareholders, but the actual shares, 46.8% of that is owned by IRAs or public pension funds. Usually these would be public pension funds for public employees in various states. And then a further 24.2% are by asset management funds. That's 71% altogether. The actual number of like individual shareholders or even corporate executives on these boards in these publicly traded companies is relatively small in terms of the number of shares that they control. The oil and gas and API folks think that this means that, you know, they're invulnerable because this is millions of ordinary Americans. My suspicion, I could be wrong on this, my suspicion is that you can negotiate to give all these people's retirement accounts a nice big buyout and make clear to them that if the individual wealthy guy shareholders are holdouts and prevent this buyout from happening, that it's going to diminish the value of the company in the long run and really severely damage a lot of people's retirement accounts. Again, you're playing a little bit of hardball there, but I think that most retirement accounts, you know, which is again, almost half of these shares, people would be much happier to take a guaranteed payment on these shares and be able to go off and invest in something else than to just try to resist and hold out. There's a little bit more uncertainty over the long run. And if the government is actively fomenting the uncertainty by saying, look, these oil and gas companies will not be allowed to exist that much longer, and they are not going to be that valuable as they once were, and we're going to diminish and reduce and end this industry, then your value as an invested retiree account is going to go down. Like, you're not going to have as much money to retire or any money to retire if you're too heavily invested in this. That allows you some leverage there. There's actually a research paper by Robert J. Shapiro, an economist, and some other folks that was commissioned by API. You can look up some statistics. Again, we'll have that in the links at arsenalfordemocracy.com in our outline here. But you can look up some of the data on like how much is actually invested from these public pension funds. The other thing is just relative to the actual overall public pension fund investment, even in the states that were studied here, you know, California and like 30 something other big and small states with pension funds, the amount that is invested in oil and gas and fossil fuels in general is not actually that much relative to their overall holdings. Again, that may be a way of providing some leverage for the government to negotiate and say, look, you're not even that heavily invested in them. Like, just take the money and go invest in something else and just walk away from the oil and gas investments. But of course, we know a lot of Republicans control these investment funds at the state level. We know that asset managers, that get a huge cut from moving around this money, they might be resistant to it. But it certainly, I think, is an interesting avenue to explore. The final thing to close out our episode that we need to talk about is, what do we do if we successfully buy out the U.S. oil and gas industry? What do we do with that? Now, I have covered that in a lot more detail in a previous episode of Arsenal for Democracy, but it was pretty hypothetical. Basically, my case is that the industry needs to be purchased and then gradually closed down. You might leave part of it for plastics production because plastics requires petroleum. But in general, over a very short time frame, you want to be winding down actual oil and gas production. You want to be moving that money into any sort of remaining royalties or incoming royalties over the final period. You want to move that directly into remediation for all the damage that the fossil fuel industry has caused. You want to move it potentially into some green tech stuff, because it would be great if you could have oil and gas companies that are now state-owned moving into sort of renewables, because that's what the private companies should have been doing if they were smart this whole time, but they're not. But probably would be a lot of pushback from the privately owned renewable energy companies. So I'm guessing most of this money will just need to be used on, you know, remediation, cleanup, and climate damage mitigation around the world.
Carbon capture, possibly other technologies.
The really important thing here is this money needs to be walled off. At the moment, energy royalties go very heavily into the treasury. $6.23 billion, which in my opinion is not even that much money. I mean, that's practically chump change at this point for the U.S. federal government. $6.23 billion come in as revenues from energy and mining royalties in the United States, according to the ONRR, Office of Natural Resource Revenue. Some of that money, a lot of that money goes right back out to states or Indian reservations to provide for a lot of programs or just however they want to use it. But a lot of the money does go into the general U.S. Treasury. Some of it goes into specific earmarked funding. The Land and Water Conservation Fund was established many decades ago, I think about a half century ago at this point. I consider that to be very insufficient protection. Congress tends to raid that money a lot for other purposes, as they do with many things that are not properly walled off, like the Social Security Trust Fund. As I've emphasized before, I think BLM currently has a pretty disastrous focus on trying to maximize the not only the revenue collection, which they don't collect that much because of the rates being so low, but literally emphasizing usage, that, you know, use it or lose it, that kind of thing. If you're emphasizing, like, they won't even sell land to people that they think are just going to hold on to it for natural resource conservation purposes. People have tried that before, you know, oh, I'll just lease this land and then prevent it from being used for oil and gas. They say, no, we can only do it if you can prove that you're going to be developing it for oil and gas. That's a really bad focus. That is not the model that we want to be pursuing if we buy out the U.S. oil and gas industry. In fact, what we want to be doing is creating a completely walled off separate model. One potential route to explore is the British model called QANGOs, which stands for quasi non-governmental organizations. That's a method, they call it ring fencing, where they sort of, it's similar to a public corporation in the United States, but it's even more protected from, we hope, although that's controversial. And, you know, of course, the conservatives go after it in England as well. But basically, you try to wall it off as this independent entity that has to operate in the public interest, you know, not just your basic environmental stuff, but climate interest, that kind of thing. It has to operate in the public interest with a specific goal of winding this down, and that the money has to be used for remediation and cannot be used for general royalties. There is also the possibility of what's called a climate sovereign wealth fund. And Nate, why don't you close us out with that? This is something that was offered up by the German Advisory Council on Climate, also known as WBGU, and that's available at g20-insights.org. They are proposing a sovereign wealth fund model that is already used for a lot of state-owned oil and gas companies, but this would be a more general thing, and they're not necessarily tying it into nationalization, but we are, of what you would do to focus on sort of climate protection issues and remediation issues at this sort of nationalized level.
Yeah, so this comes from the G20 various agreements looking towards the 2030 agenda, as I mentioned, coming out of Paris, And so they say they recommend in particular that G20 countries establish transformative sovereign wealth funds, which they would also call future funds. And they recommend that this would enable G20 countries to be more active in financial markets as stakeholders with the goal of promoting socially responsible structural change to create a sustainable economic and social system. These future funds should draw on the revenues of CO2 taxes and emissions trading, as well as from a generational component levied on estates. The investments made by the transformative sovereign wealth funds should be oriented towards climate change targets and the SDGs, sustainable development goals. Profits should be used in advance or to advance equity and the common good. And so they're clearly looking forward a sort of investment model, potentially socializing some of the benefits. So
right, it is state capitalism fundamentally, but trying to add this component on top of sovereign wealth funds and making them specifically a model that is dedicated toward mitigating the future damage and containing the future damage of sort of the climate impact that we've been having so far and will continue to have for some time, and trying to do it in a responsible manner that draws funding from the appropriate revenue streams as opposed to just general taxes.
Yeah, and this is coming from the G20, so I don't really expect it to be all that radical, but at the same time, it's clear that, say, the Germans recognize the need to invest in the future here.
Right,
so.
And this is a potential thing that you could do, say, with the remaining royalties and sort of the, once you've bought up these companies, they technically have some value left for a while until you've wound them down. This is something you could potentially do with them. So again, this was just a very broad overview to get people thinking about it, get people thinking about what the details might look like. Again, we're talking about a constitutional fair market value buyout with various negotiation and leverage applied to get something at about $1 trillion or so to buy the U.S. oil and gas industry and roll it back and wind it down. I hope people found this informative in some way. Again, we may have gotten some of the details wrong hypothetically, but this is again just to kind of get that conversation rolling and get it into people's minds in the way that we talk about socializing medicine. Nate, thank you so much for being here and helping me with this topic this week.
Great to be here, Bill.
And as one quick final reminder, beginning August 29th, our show will be airing on Tuesdays and released online on Tuesdays, Tuesday at noon on WVUD. So we will be changing from Wednesday evenings to Tuesdays at noon for Arsenal for Democracy. Please make sure to note that change if it affects your listening schedule. Again, that's Tuesday, August 29th, that the schedule change takes effect. So after today's episode, we have one more episode released on Wednesday evenings, and beginning on August 29th, these episodes will be released on Tuesdays, airing Tuesday at noon on WVUD. Thank you so much for listening. That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email afdradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.